It's great to see you. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic.
I'm Tom.
And it is great to see you. I hope you can handle redneck Southern English. That's about what I've got. I get nervous when Danish people get behind me. I got particularly that one. It is great to see you. It's good to be back in Denmark. And we had a great time. I think he was talking about that. We had a great time out in the woods and wonderful, wonderful. Some cooking fools out there. I tell you what, we had some groceries that were out of sight. And so this is a great way to cap it off. This is my way of getting to say goodbye. Because with any luck, I'll leave on an early flight and head whatever direction that is. My wife's hoping it's home, but we'll see. And I'm delighted to be here. What I want to do is just what we basically do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. You know, the great thing here is that we don't preach and teach. What we do is share our experience. And we found that that has an ability to create identification second to none. And languages don't even matter that much. I've identified people, I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. But I knew what they meant, you know. So hopefully that'll be that. And I'll tell you as much as I can. And what time do we quit? I know you'll tell me.
We have about 3/4 an hour now, and then we take a half an hour break, and then you're on for an hour more.
Me? That's better than it did me out there. I'd get about 20 minutes and call a 2-hour break. And that's good. I was a guy that... I walked into my first AA meeting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday, the 2nd of February, in 1957. And I don't think I have ever felt any more out of place anywhere on earth than I did in that meeting. I was 24 years old, and you know, any math will tell you that means I'm now 61. Well, or in the neighborhood thereof. But I felt totally out of place. That I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I had a lot of other people who believed I was, but I didn't. I thought I was too young. I thought I was too smart. I thought one of these days, if I could just get my act together, look out world, here I come. That's what I believed. In the meantime, I'm going right down the tube. Yeah, I should have been able to identify, but I couldn't because of age primarily. But I'd done all the stuff that goes with so many of us on the way here, with jails, hospitals, waking up in the wrong town, waking up in the wrong place. I woke up one time married, for God's sakes. I mean, to a woman I didn't even know. And so I asked her, who might she be? And she said, Mrs. Ivester. And I said, uh-oh, that's bad whiskey when you wake up like that. And I tell you, whether you meant it or not, the divorce costs just as much. And so I had plenty of garbage behind me that would have certainly made me feel, but I didn't. Yeah, I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. I'd been thrown out of the military with an undesirable discharge as being unfit for military service due to alcoholism when I was 20 years old. But it didn't mean anything. All of that was premature. You know, I knew that it was troubling. I knew they had enough of me. And when they broke my sword and sent me away, I didn't believe it. And so when I walked in there, I mentioned the importance of identification. When I walked in that room, I didn't identify with anybody. There were 300 people in that, almost as many as here. I'm saying that for the purpose of recording, so they'll think we got a huge crowd in here. But I didn't identify. Most of the people in the room had drunk more years than I was years old. Now, you know, I mean, we don't lie in Alcoholics Anonymous, but sometimes we may add a little here or there just to make it come out right, you know. And now that's not lying, that's just sort of smoothing the story. And I heard a guy in there one time say he stayed drunk for 40 years, never sobered up. Now, I have a little credibility problem with that. I just don't believe it. I just don't believe any human could do that. One guy said he'd been married 7 times to the same woman. I don't believe that. I mean, even drunk, you're not that crazy. So But I listened to a lot of stuff, and I just didn't identify with it. Felt totally out of place. And I heard people talking about alcoholism as an illness. I found that an awkward, embarrassing concept. Now, what on earth is an illness about drinking whiskey? It's what afterward is the illness. You know, that's the illness. But thinking of drinking as an illness was foreign to me. What are you talking about, malaria or something? It just made no sense. And so I was very much out of place in AA. And thank God I walked into a real group of Alcoholics Anonymous, real solid group. It was in a penitentiary, but that made it even more real. And it was a good, solid group that was based in the legacies. It was based in recovery and unity and service. And so I got introduced to AA in a good, solid group. And it's a funny thing about a group. There's a sensitivity to dealing with people the way they need to be dealt with. Some people need a boot. Some need a pat on the back. Some need encouragement. Some need discouragement. But in a group, there tends to be a sensitivity to sort of pick up on people and treat them like they need to be treated. Nobody teaches it. It's just an instinct that develops. And that's what happened to me. I went in there and I truly didn't believe I was alcoholic. I knew I'd gotten into some kind of a religious colony because all he did was pray and read. Just like, well, he didn't pray, but he read. He started to pray, but he backed out. And But that's all they did. It's like a reading scripture and then pray about every 2 seconds, it seemed like. Now, that was troubling to me because I had decided as a child that I just didn't believe that stuff. I mean, before I started school, I'd already made up my mind that I just didn't believe that stuff. And if I ever got big enough to get my hand out of my mother's, I wouldn't be going back in there anymore. Now, I'm not talking about a confused child. I'm talking about a defiant child who just flat didn't believe it. And I didn't tell anybody, but I just didn't believe it. It sounded scary. I'd see people, I was down in the Bible Belt, and people get frenzied in religion down there. They're not real calm and peaceful. They do tend to yell a lot and jump up and run up and down. I didn't find that warm and welcoming. I found it scary. And so I take a look at that and say, geez, I'm getting out of here. And so when I got out, I never went into a church one time till I was sober 11 years. So I wasn't just a confused child. I was somebody who had a real spiritual malady. And when you walk into a spiritual program with a spiritual malady, that's not a comfortable fit, eh? And so that was my feeling when I went in. So that's why I'm so thankful that I went into a group that was rough guys, but they were sensitive to the needs of the members. Did somebody fall out? Is it new blood? I always like to pick up on new blood if they're there. I can smell it. But that's what happened, and so the guys kind of picked up on me. And there was a group that did an excellent job. They didn't do a newcomer program like we do in my group, but they did a basic introduction to AA. And I remember stuff that happened. This is well over 50 years ago, probably 53 years ago. But I remember it as clearly as if it were today that, you know, what happened to some of the older members. Older meant probably a year sober. And what they do is meet with the new people and basically explain what AA is. What's an alcoholic? What's anonymous? What's a sponsor? What's a home group? Just the basic, rudimentary things that you need to know in AA. A guy got up one day, and it really, really struck me that, you know, sometimes you'll have the steps on a shade. That he had something like that. It was on the board. And it had steps on it. And he said, there are 200 words in those steps. And if you'll take the actions laid out in those steps as honestly as you're capable of doing, when you get through, you'll be a different guy. And it doesn't even matter what your motives are. And I thought, come on, man. I mean, I didn't just fall off the turnip truck, for God's sake. I know you can't throw a curve and then give me something straight back. And how skeptical, but the guy was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. Because over a little bit of time, I got into a fundamental, just sort of get my best hold and doing those steps to the best of my ability. And that boy was right. Because when I got through with that, I had an absolute transformation. I was a different guy. Now, I was still 6 feet tall and ugly, but I was a different guy, a different guy. And I learned a way of life that was totally foreign to me. I learned to operate with dignity for the first time in my life. Honesty, trustworthiness, integrity. You know, words that were totally foreign to me. And they became practices that were natural in my life. And so those steps are powerful. That's not just some little nursery rhyme. That is a powerful, powerful program of recovery that can take a guy like me and not only housebreak him, but give him a brand new way of life beyond anything you could imagine. Now, that didn't happen in the beginning, but it was extremely important to me that I went into a group like that, and ever since then, that I've always been a guy that's been committed to a group. I've never been without a home group since the day I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm somebody who plants and stays where he's planted. That's the way I operate. And so that's how I got introduced to that. I really didn't believe I was an alcoholic. You know, that I'd been in jail I don't know how many times. I like to think I was in jail the exact right number of times. Maybe one more wouldn't have been enough. And maybe one more, one less wouldn't have been enough. Maybe one more would have been too many. I like to think it was the right one, but I haven't found it necessary to go since I got sober. But it was enough to at least, certainly lay a track record that could look back at and as time came. And so I didn't identify with people. I didn't identify. You know, every speaker I ever met, I was the youngest guy in every meeting I attended for years. And I mean, everybody wasn't old as Methuselah then, but it seemed like it to me. And I was in AA for years before I ever met anybody my age. Young people were not coming off the production line. If they were coming off, they missed the playing field because I never saw any, anywhere I ever went. When I finally saw a guy my age, I swear to God, I wanted to kiss him. I mean, I resisted, but I was so glad to see that guy. Man, folks, I'm sick of people patting me on the head. I don't know why you want to pat folks on the head, but people would meet up and they'd say, "How old are you, son?" 24, sir. Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. And say, "Do you realize that at your age you could look forward to as much as 50 years in AA?" Tell you what. Now that might have struck you right in the heartstrings, but while he was doing that, his eyes kind of rolled back in his head. He looked like he'd going into rapture or something. And while he was in rapture, I'm thinking, my God, what if this thing works? I'm going to be in this leper colony for the rest of my life. You know? And so I was overly thrilled about that. You know, 'cause good God, drunk was bad enough. And now we'll be sober with a bunch of righteous people. And so there was a... the guy was right, by golly. I was able to stay sober for the next 50 years. Then some. Amazing stuff. But that's who I was. I was just kind of a lost guy there, and fortunately had that good sound group. I had real trouble identifying with people because of the age gap for one thing and the experience gap for another. That one of the things that kept me coming back to AA was not so much identifying with the story, but you, like, I know what I'll be saying to you, but I have no clue what you'll be hearing. That's none of my business. But I know what I'm trying to say. And people who were coming into that institution and telling their stories, what I thought they said was that they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. And I said, well, my God, if that's what it is, I've had that all my life. You know, I've been in trouble all of my life and never sober. I've never been in jail sober. I've never woke up in the wrong state sober. in a burning car, mine, sober, married to a stranger. No, there was plenty of things that said very loudly that there was big-time trouble in River City. And so when I heard people tell their stories of what it sounded like was they were alcoholic because they got in trouble, that was not a real definitive kind of a deal, but it was enough to keep me in the chair, right? It was enough to keep me in the chair. And I never left. I stayed in there for 3.5 years and never missed a single meeting. And not because I was a deep-seated convert, but just because I think there was a wisp of hope that was there, that just maybe there might be something there. And so I started to go to work. You know, this is a powerful program, and I'll tell you how far. I'm not going to give you a whole vivid thing about, you know, life in an institution. You know, this program is exactly the same for people. I don't care if they're on the moon. There is no different program for different environments. It's exactly the same program. And that's the way it was for me. You know, I started to get into the fellowship and had enough to hang on to and fumble my way through the steps. You know, there's some myth that exists that we used to do it better back in those days. That, trust me, that is a myth. It's a myth. Yeah, if we did, they sure hid it from me, because I never saw anybody take anybody through the steps. That was a concept that hadn't even been developed. And what we did, we read the book. We only had one, and we read the book. But that didn't mean much. You know, back then, the character of the program was it's a busy beating drunks over the head with the book to get them loaded up to try to get into a meeting that didn't have time to read it. It was the only weapon we had available. And it wasn't any real refined method for doing it. Didn't have a sponsor, but I had a guy that I trusted a lot. There's just another member that I trusted and I was comfortable with. He was locked up like me, and I just somehow couldn't quite be generous enough to ask somebody in the next cage over to be a sponsor. So I just didn't do it. But he was a good friend and a trusted friend. And so we'd just sort of walk through the steps together. We'd talk about them and chat about it and all that kind of thing. And when I got to the point of complete my inventory, and then getting ready to take the fifth step. You know, the book cautions that we need to be very careful about how we choose, who we choose, and get the right setting and all that kind of place. But I can assure you, you don't have to be in the Sistine Chapel to do a fifth step. I did mine on what looked like a park bench, a beat-up park bench, on the yard of a maximum custody penitentiary, with 6,300 and something people wandering around. It'd be about like the bench over where we were over by the lake. Be about doing it right there with 1,000 people milling around. And so I sat down with that guy and opened up for the first time to any human I'd ever met. And that's the first time I had ever got completely honest with any human being. Let anybody know who I was. When we got through, that guy knew me better than my mother knew me, by far. And it was a truly, truly defining moment for me. You know, to really realize that I'm in the right place and I'm a guy with a heap of trouble. And so it was a defining kind of a moment for me. I did exactly what it says in the book to do after you complete that fifth step. I went back to my lodging, got the book out, took a look at the first five proposals, and said, "How you doing?" And I said, "Well, by golly, I've done the best I can." And that was good enough. And it was enough to keep me here. Now, that was a huge, huge moment, that whole inventory business and that whole business of doing that thing. Then I was faced with a dilemma that I'm sure a lot of other people do too. I wanted to get better, but I didn't want to get too good. I mean, Well, I started praying. I'd kind of pray with one eye closed, you know, because I didn't want to go the whole jump. You know, I'd say, you know, and I'd ask for help with something, and then I'd say, "But not right now. Yeah, I mean, hold on. Wait till Tuesday or something." And so I was reluctant to take that big jump in there. But it was a start, eh? It was a start. And so, it defining stuff. When I got into 6 and 7, the dilemma for me was that I couldn't figure out how you're going to do those steps and not get good. Now, if you're going to remove all my defects of character, and I'm wanting to remove them all. Now, there's some of those things felt good. I mean, lying was handy. It helps out a lot. It can smooth out bad situations. And so I wasn't sure when to give that up. I liked a little misbehavior every once in a while. And I just didn't want to get too pure. And so I had a lot of fears about that thing. And what finally resolved it for me was that when I got honest with myself, I didn't want to be the butt of jokes. That's what I was, yeah. I wasn't the entertainer. I was the butt of jokes. I was the circus clown. I was the fool at the party. That's not what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a nice guy to be around, but that's not what I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a buffoon. And so it was that kind of thinking that caused me to get rid of those defects, those things that weigh me down, that hold me back and will until I do the actions that will help them get away. And so I'm moving through. I'm moving through the place. Got really active in the group. Became a very, very active member and have stayed that way. And when I started getting down to cases, that whole process of being willing to change was important. But then what follows it is what it takes to make the change occur. And I was a guy who, just like many of us who come in here, I had tons of damage to account for. I had tons of harm that I had done. And a lot of, the surprising thing to me was that when I started doing it, it wasn't as much as I thought it was going to be. You know, I first started, I thought my 8-step list was going to be about a half a mile long. Because I was counting every time somebody hurt their fist, breaking my nose, you know. Felt like I needed to make amends to them or something. And then I got real about that. Yeah, that's typical Saturday night behavior in some joint. That's not amends. That's just the price of the ticket of admission. That just goes with it. And so I started to get realistic about that and got the list. Surprisingly, it shrunk appreciably. It still had a lot of names on there. You know, family. You know, I always had this kind of stupid notion that I didn't hurt my family because I had the decency to be gone. You know, my family never knew where I was from the time I was 16 years old till I got sober in AA. They had no clue whether I was alive or dead or what country or anything else. They just knew I was somewhere probably. No clue. You know, how much more cruel could you be to a mother than to deprive her of her own son, eh? And so when I started looking at it realistically, I saw it had done enormous damage in a lot of ways. But the list was shorter, but more formidable. And so I started taking a look at my life and what it was going to take to get straightened out, because that's the purpose of it in the book. Now, I was a guy that, you probably gathered, I was not in a finishing school. I was in a maximum custody penitentiary. And I was in there because I committed a crime that was... It's so horrible, there's no suitable punishment for it. There's no adequate punishment for it. I did what many alcoholics do, unfortunately. Many alcoholics do. I'm not the only guy that's done it. But I woke up in jail one morning in the town I was living in, Flint, Michigan, and assumed I was in there for the same as always. You know, it's either drunk or hustling or scuffling on the street or some junk stuff like that. That's normally what it always was. And so I came to in there, and it was no big deal. And I knew the routine. You know, at 10 o'clock in the morning, the jailer would come by, and he was just available. If anybody wanted to try to get out, you could tell him your sad story, and he may let you out, he may not. And so I went up to the bars, and he came by and said, "Hey, guy," we knew each other. And I said, "When can I get out?" And he just looked at me with pure scorn on his face and said, "I hope never." I had no clue what he's talking about. No clue whatsoever. But I hope now. I knew he was serious. I mean, he wasn't playing. I knew he was quite serious. He didn't explain anything. He kept going. I went back into the tank where all the guys were, and a fella I didn't know him, but a guy said, "Do you know what you're in here for?" I said, "No, I don't have any idea," because I figured it was the business as usual. And he said, "Well, last night, some guy was driving a car blind drunk down the main street of the city and struck and killed two people, whose only mistake was trying to cross the street where you were driving, apparently." He said, "They arrested you for the crime." I had no clue what he was talking about. I mean, I understood what he was saying, but I had absolutely no clue of that. And, mind's a strange thing. It won't accept what it can't handle, eh? It won't accept. And my response was, that was more news than I could handle. I mean, even though I was a character, I was not an inhuman person. I was not some cold-blooded guy that could be casual about human life. And when I even considered the fact that possibly I'd caused two young folks to die, that was a bit more than I could accommodate. And so I just refused to believe it and then gradually accepted what appeared to be the truth, that I had done more damage than any alcoholic ever ought to be allowed to do. My response, I guess, was understandable. I just wanted to disappear. I didn't want to do anything. It's the only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. I didn't want to get out. You know, I was ashamed to be breathing, locked up or whatever. And so I just sat there. And I'll never know why or who, but there was some policeman there at that jail that apparently saw the condition I was in, because I didn't handle it well. I mean, it was just unacceptable information. And I simply couldn't handle the world. And I was almost comatose when trying to deal with that. And so this guy saw that, and he called my folks. They had the records there in the jail, so I mean, it didn't take any real searching to do. He got the address, the phone number, and called my folks. And said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble, and he's in pretty bad shape. And the way he's doing now, he's talking himself into more than he was already in." Because they asked me, "Did you do something?" I said, "Yeah, probably did." Yeah, I mean, it didn't matter. I was just done. And all I wanted to do was be gone. And so my family did what families of alcoholics have done since time memorial. And that's reach in when it doesn't even need reaching in. But families will just stick it out one more time and one more time and one more time. I honestly believe, doesn't mean anything to anybody but me, but I honestly believe that the family of alcoholics are punished more than we alcoholics, because they deal with a clear mind, with totally unexplainable behavior. And how do you explain some idiot that just does the kind of goofy stuff I do? And how do you live with the constant fright and all that goes with it? But my family did what families do. It made no sense. They couldn't afford a trip to Michigan, where I was from North Carolina. They couldn't. They worked in a mill. They barely made enough to live on. But they made the trip up there, as families do. Got an attorney that I didn't want. I didn't want out of jail. I didn't want anything. I just wanted to be gone. He got an attorney. He did what attorneys do, and negotiated with whoever he does and arranged for me to be released on bond. I was charged with involuntary manslaughter, and it was scheduled for trial later on in fall. And so he negotiated that release. I didn't know how to tell anybody that I didn't want out of jail. I didn't know how to say that to anybody. I was just about past carrying on logical conversations with anybody. And so they arranged that. I was released on bond on the 17th of July of 1956. I knew that I wouldn't drink. It had nothing to do with alcoholism. I truly did not believe I was alcoholic. It had nothing to do with any. It was just that, how could you possibly drink after having done something as horrible as that? On the other hand, the question, more logical question is, how would you not drink after something like that? But I didn't know that. And so I got out, didn't know what to do, totally out of place, couldn't stand to be around people, couldn't look at anybody, walked the streets all day, all night, till about noon the next day. And then I started to drink, of course. And from the 18th of July of 56 till the 19th of November, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. I mean, nobody. And that's not a casual statement. I'm somebody who has done thousands of 12-step calls. Not a few. I've done thousands. I held an alcoholic in my arms while he died on a 12-step call. And even, excuse me, I don't know where I got to bark, but I've been barking all weekend. But even as he died, he was protesting that he wasn't like us. And it went under. So I understand that kind of thing. You know, and I understand the hopelessness of that kind of situation. And so I didn't drink, and then about noon that next day I started to drink, and literally drank like nobody I've ever seen. And with all the thousands of folks, I've never seen one like me. I just literally gave in to the condition. I have no question that what I was trying to do was an overt suicide mission. I think the only reason I didn't just jump in front of a truck or something was I didn't want to put another burden on a family already had too many. And I guess I thought in my twisted logic that if I was just found dead of an overdose or hit by a train or whatever, there would at least be a question, you know, and it wouldn't be a suicide to add to their list. And so, but that's what it was. And I don't think there's any question. I didn't plan it or anything like that. But I can remember what it was like to be in my late teens and early 20s and look at myself in the mirror and want to gag at what I saw. The best I could come up with, man, why don't you just end it? Everybody would be better off, including you. And so, you know, you're really on a roll when that's what your life has come to. And that's what I was. You know, I was just a guy who tried my best to stay blacked out, drunk as a bum, for permanently. Then I didn't know it was going to be, but on the 19th of November, I had what, so far, thank God, has been my last drink. It's not when my recovery started. I think there's a big difference between not drinking and recovery. And so I started not drinking on the 19th of November. I didn't have any holy intent or take an oath or anything like that. I just said, I'm not, no drinking. And I finished a bottle of gin on the morning of the 19th, and it had probably 3 or 4 inches in the bottle, finished it off, went to court. I knew it was a one-way trip. I knew I wouldn't be back. Had no question about it whatsoever. And so when I was in it, went in and tried, I listened to the testimony just like the people on the jury listened to it. It was as new to me as it was to them. I heard the police officer who investigated the crime describe the scene. First time I'd ever heard it. And that, you know, he said he's there investigating, and he sees this guy wobbling down the street that he identified as me, and said, I walked up to him and said, was there an accident here? He said, there sure was. And that was compelling evidence, eh? That was compelling evidence. And so that's how I woke up that next morning in the jail, dealing with that kind of situation. And so, when we went into the trial, I didn't have any anxiety about it. I knew what was going to happen. I had no question. And sure enough, exactly what happened. I was found guilty and sentenced to a sentence of 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I'd never been in, I mean, I was a character. You know, I was not a Pillsbury Doughboy. I was a character. But I wasn't a vicious person. I wasn't a criminal. I wasn't a thief. You know, I mean, you know, if you left a drink sitting on the bar, I might handle it for you. But that is not thievery. You know, that is called sharing. So I might do that, but I would never. And in the environment I lived in, it's funny how you'll adapt to the environment. If you knew anything about Flint, Michigan, or Detroit, you've probably heard of them if you haven't seen them. Those are just totally antisocial environments. It's almost like a school of piranha that live there and just sort of try to attack each other. And so I lived in that environment, and I was never a criminal in my life. I never was somebody that robbed anybody or stole stuff. But the economy in that kind of environment was that there were only two types of people who were actively involved in productive living. It was either the rollee or the roller, because in that town, somebody's going to get rolled every night. If you're frisky, you may be the rollee. And if not, you'd have rolled her up. Either way. But that's what it was. And I wasn't reared to do that. But it's funny how you adapt to stuff, eh? As you drift into that. If what seemed would have seemed totally impossible to conceive became normal. And so that's what it was. And that's the guy that was there. And so when I was found guilty, the judge sentenced me to that sentence. I had, I guess, a very natural reaction. I had an instinctive reaction of fear. But even I'd been in jail all over the place. A jail and a maximum custody penitentiary are not in the same league. And I knew, I'd never been there, but I knew some of the characters that went into the prison I would be going into, and I knew it was not going to be Disneyland with that crew in there. And so I walked in, absolutely resigned to my fate. I walked in that day on a chain with five other guys, went through that gate and the fence, and when I walked in there, I knew without any question that was a one-way trip, that I would not be coming back out. I knew that. And I didn't care. I really didn't care. And that wasn't callous disregard. I was just through. Absolutely through. And 6,380-something guys in there. And I knew if I ever left, it would be toes up. And so that was the guy walking in. I'm through with life. I honestly believe that the most powerful word in the language of recovery is a simple little word called surrender. Surrender. About giving up. The game is over. The fight is done. And I lost. I am beat big time. So I was blessed with that. Blessed with surrender. I just had given up. I had no aspirations, no hope. This was a long time ago. I'd never heard of AA. They didn't talk about that where I drank. I never heard of anybody trying to help a drunk. I mean, how would you do that? Take the bottle away from him? That's a totally foreign language to me. And so I had no illusions about what you'd do. And so what they did was a typical thing to do in an institution, whether it's a hospital, treatment center, prison, or whatever, same routine. They'd get you in there and tell me about your life. You know, who's your social history? They did that. And when they got through, the guy made the same diagnosis everybody who ever captured me made. I never had anybody diagnose me as anything except problem drinker, drunk, crazy. Never anything but. Always booze. And he was no different. He said, he had a record. The record was about as thick as that big book. And that was my record. There wasn't a single deliberate, premeditated crime in the entire thing. 3-inch record, all it said was drunk and fill in the blank. If you can do it drunk, I've been arrested for doing it drunk, whatever it is. And that's what it always was. That whole record was just that. And he showed me that record. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. I said, yeah, good God, that's obvious. And he said something I'd never heard. Now, I'd had people when they were throwing me out of the Army. I got thrown out with an undesirable discharge when I'm 20 years old. And they gave me a farewell speech. I'd had people tell me that I needed to straighten up. Yeah, and I never had anybody try to put a solution to a problem. I never heard of anything like that. And so that's what he was doing. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble. And I said, yeah. He said, we have an AA group here. Didn't mean a thing to me. I'd never heard of such a thing. I'd never heard of anybody helping a drunk. You know, that was no shock. I mean, my God, anybody drinks much I did is going to do goofy stuff. And so it was not shocking when he said that. He said we had an AA group. I'd never heard the term. It didn't mean a thing to me. You know, he could have said we have a ballet corps. It would have meant just as much. Didn't mean a thing. And so he ended the conversation. I didn't ask any questions. See, I wasn't getting engaged in conversation. I just listened to him. And then a few days later, thank God, you know, this was before we started putting leashes on people and dragging them into AA. We weren't that refined back then. He just basically said, man, you've got a lot of trouble. We got an AA group. You ought to go. That's it. If I'd have never gone, he couldn't have cared less, nor me. I had no clue what it was about. And it went back to my cell. A few days later, I got a little slip of paper. It wasn't a letter. It was just a little slip of paper. It said, you can go to your first AA meeting. 2nd of February, 1957, which happened to be at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday. And thank God I was beat. Yeah, I was an extremely isolated person. Yeah, I made a lot of noise and all that kind of junk, but I never let anybody get close to me. I wouldn't take stuff from them. I might take it away from them, but I wouldn't take stuff from people, because if you take it from them, you get them with it. And so I was a very, very resistant guy. I was an isolated guy. Made a lot of fun. You wouldn't have figured that out by watching me in action, but deep down inside, that's what I was. And the isolated people, last thing they want to do is go mix it up with somebody. That's the last thing. And so this guy told me that thing, and they announced, I heard the announcement, I'd heard it before. They announced AA. The guy would hit the rail with a big old key, and it'd dong, it'd ring all over the prison. And when it died down, he'd say, AA! Well, that meant if you wanted to go to AA, this was back before the electronic days, they would turn a big old key if it go open your door. Otherwise, they'd throw a lock like they used to switch trains in a freight yard. You know, they'd throw this switch, and if you wanted to go to whatever they announced, you slide your door back, step out. Well, I did that day. I didn't want to go anywhere, but I was totally defeated. I was totally beat. I had surrendered. And so I just responded to command, just like a dog would do a trick for a bone. And so I stepped out. I didn't want to go to AA. While I didn't know what it was, I had the impression it was going to be some kind of a religious freak out. I could feel that. I'd seen when a lot of clean old guys would come down to county jail and sing hymns and tell stuff. I would blubber and break down every time they did that, enjoying whatever they were selling. It lasted about 30 minutes, you know. So I was used to that kind. I figured it'd be something like that. And I walked into that first meeting just like I described and sat down. And totally out of place. But thank God that found that way to start having a life and to start building a life. Now that institution, I'll just simply say this, was as vicious an environment. I've been in all kinds of environments. That's the most vicious environment I've ever seen in my life. Just a totally predatory environment. I sat in my cell one night and listened to a fellow get his brains beat out with a hammer over a package of cigarettes, for God's sake. Powerless to do anything about it. So that's what it was. And stepping forward to do anything was a little out of the ordinary. But I did. I stepped in and sat in that group. And started to get involved. You know, that... You know, people don't. If you're in that kind of environment, you'll do whatever you can for entertainment. And back in those days, the cells were lined up across a big old open, deep space, and you only entertainment is look at each other. And I got a nickname. Everybody gets a nickname in AA. My nickname when I got active in the program was Chief Winehead, and I'm not even an Indian, but Chief Winehead. And they would announce AA, and I'd step out, and all the kooks on the other side would start their calls. You know, there he goes, Chief Winehead, going to get his coffee, going to get those cookies. Well, I thought, God knows I am not going to do that stunk again, but I did every time. Step on out there and do it. I hope they had fun, because I left most of them sitting there, you know, and so I hope they enjoyed what they had. I'm kind of glad he did that, because it's a test. It was a test. You know, nobody gives you a standing ovation for coming to AA. And they certainly didn't give me any standing ovation. They gave me catcalls and whistles. And I'm thankful for that, because it taught me I don't need a standing ovation to do anything. You know, that I got to take it up and go with it. And so I started working and got into that. As I mentioned, I got through the fifth step. And then when I got into amends, I don't normally talk about it, I'm going to talk about it tonight a little bit, but it's just the right need to do it. When I did my list of amends, it was huge, and then it came down to family and then some other people that I'd taken advantage of. There were some people that just made that list that had to be dealt with. You know, obviously, the victims who died in an accident, them. Their families were definitely a very big part of that. And that was something that was on my mind 24 hours a day, every day. And so when I started trying to figure out how could you possibly make amends for something like that, it seems impossible, eh? It seems impossible. All you have to do is follow the directions. And so I started to do that. The way I like to do it, in real simple, the way I like to do an eight-step list, I want to get three columns. One of them is to specifically name who I hurt. Second is to put specifically what the hurt was. And then third, what can I do to make that right? And that's what I do. That's what I have people do that I'm working with. I think it's important to get right to the point and be specific. You know, I suffered from global guilt. I felt like I needed to make amends to the world for just being here. And so it was important for me to get nailed down to specific stuff. Very glaring on that list were the victims of that crime. Yeah, very glaring. And there were some things I could do. I started to make amends to my family. And you know, even before I was in AA, just as a human being, when I was in jail waiting trial, I had some, you know, street people are weird dudes. They'll roll you one day, but they'll put their life on the line the next. I can't tell you how many guys I had come to the jail and say, can we put down a story for you? Simply meaning we'll risk our freedom to help you get yours. But I didn't want that. I asked some of those guys to call the families involved in that and ask them if they'd be willing to hear from me. But you got just a common courtesy would require that. And so they contacted folks. Both families said, understandably, no, we don't want to hear from him. Understandably. It doesn't make it go away. It doesn't relieve the responsibility 1 ounce. And so when I got to that, and I'm thinking, how on earth am I going to do it? There were a couple of ways that I could do. One was to start immediately doing what I call indirect amends. That, you know, with the victims who died, certainly there is only so much I could do. But I did everything I even heard of that had the remotest possibility of being helpful in that. And it was to some extent, but it was not enough. But indirect amends are a very appropriate thing that can be done when it's the best you can do. And so, there's no question about it, I've been doing indirect amends of that for 53 years and still do. It's connected to a lot of things that I do, and there are enormous opportunities to do it. So I was able to make a start. The families were the real quandary, but because they're going on with life. And never went away. And now I did something, only 5 minutes. I'll talk faster than that. Huh? In 5 minutes? All right. I'll just introduce you to that and then finish it up when we come back. But what I did, I don't normally mess with the steps. But on the step which says, made a list of people in harm become willing, I added a word that become willing, and then I put this word opportunity. And so what I prayed for was willingness and opportunity. And trust me, I never did one single thing to make anything happen. Nothing whatsoever. Because it's a delicate situation. You can't just sort of charge into something where there's extreme opportunity to do some damage. So I was very careful about that. But what I'll tell you about when you come back is that I was able to make full amends to everybody involved in that, in the family, with good outcome. And so that's vital. You know, that's vital. There's a lot of stuff that are important to me in my story, but that was critically important, that I get to take care of my responsibility, make amends to the very best of my ability. And those steps in that eighth and ninth step, those are the keys to freedom. And without those steps, there is no freedom, because all that damage we've done and the defects we carry, they'll go with us to the grave. They don't die of old age. And so that amends process is vital. So I guess, what are you going to say, boss? Well, y'all know how to take a break. Go how long ago meet? Oh, half hour. My God, you can go eat a half hour for a break. Then you help me.